Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September 4th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this morning, our speaker is Bob Keller. Today, he will be continuing his series on the Columbia River. Today's session number is 2 and is titled, The Columbia River of Native America. Let's listen in.
I'm Bob Keller. I think most of you have been here before, here last night. Now we've had 2 sessions so far. One was a general introduction to the Columbia and to rivers. And then yesterday we talked about the various uses of the river, how they are not all compatible. This morning I want to explain to you as briefly as I can something about the native cultures along the Columbia River, especially the lower part of the river. That's a big order. It's going to be very sort of general, skipping over lots of things, but I'll give you sort of an outline. If we have time, we can have some discussion. First, though, here are some what I consider the best books about this subject. It's a book by a man, Jared Ramsey, called Coyote Was Going There. It's a collection of native stories, legends, myths about the Oregon country. There's a whole section of about 20 stories just about the Columbia River. This is by far the best collection there is of this type. There's another book called Indian Legends of the Pacific Northwest. It has a lot of Columbia stories in it also, but it's not nearly as good as the Ramsey collection because it's been cleaned up. The best book on native cultures of the Columbia is this one by a professor at the University of Washington named Eugene Hun, Mishawana, the Big River, Mid-Columbia Indians and Their Land. This is a very thorough, exhaustive study based on field research of the native cultures in this area. The first white people to come in here and really try to record carefully what they saw about native life and culture were Lewis and Clark. And it's very profitable to get hold of their journals and read about the sections you're interested in. There's detailed descriptions of the land, the animals, the flora, the people, the lodgings, the shelters, in the Lewis and Clark journals. And although they didn't understand a lot of what they saw, they still were writing down some fairly accurate descriptive material. A book by Robert Ruby called The Chinook Indians is about the tribes, the people at the mouth of the river. The Hun book only goes down to about where the Bonneville Dam now is, and from there on, it's a Chinookan people, and this book is about them. That book is so-so, I'd say. It's not very good on the ethnography or on the native cultures as such. A new book just came out this year by Robert Boyd called People of the Dalles. And it's a very specific study just about the cultures right in the Dalles area, although it puts them in context. It has a great amount of detail. It's based on the autobiography and the journals of the Methodist missionary who lived there for 7 years and who kept detailed records of what he saw, and then Henry Perkins. The best single book about the whole story, about the native cultures, the coming of the white people, the treaties, the landscape, all put together in a extremely moving and powerful narrative, 700 pages long, is by Alvin Josephy. It's called The Nez Perce Indians and the Opening of the Northwest. If you don't know anything about this region, really want to begin to understand it, get a feel for it, that's the one book of all of these I would recommend starting with. And finally, there are two excellent novels, fiction, by Craig Leslie, a Portland author. One is called Winter Kill. And those of you who were at the film last night know we were at the end off on the hunting subject. And Winter Kill is about people live along the river, but it's mainly about hunting back more over toward the Snake River. And the second novel, River Song, is about fishing on the Columbia. Both of those are very good novels. They do an excellent job of capturing both a sense of the past, but especially the experience of Native people today living in the late 20th century. Okay. There are lots of other books on this subject, lots of anthropology books, but these are the main ones, or what I consider the best ones. I'm going to start by reading two Native stories. Indeed, I think stories is the right word for these. Often people read these and think this is the Indian religion. That's not true. Their religion was something quite different from these. Just like our fairy stories or our legends we tell and pass down are not our religion, or not the Christian religion. Nevertheless, the stories contain messages and meanings and reflect things about the culture and how people looked at things. We have to also have to bear in mind as we're reading these, I'm reading them in English. They're originally told in the native language. And as in all of all people, when you translate from one language to another, especially languages which are radically different like these, you'll lose a lot. But with that in mind, these stories are still, I think, quite interesting and serve as an introduction. Long ago, when Coyote was the big man on the earth, this valley was covered by a big lake. At that time, there was no Columbia River. West of us, between the lake and the ocean, was a long ridge of mountains. But the Columbia River did not go through it. Indians today believe that. Coyote was smart enough to see that the salmon would come up from the ocean to be food for his people here, if he would make a hole through the mountains. So he went down to a place near where Portland is now, and with his powers, he dug a hole through the mountains there. The water went through the hole and onto the ocean. The water in the big lake up here was drained, and the water flowing out of it made the Columbia River. Coyote got the Columbia to flow through that hole the way it does today. Then the salmon came up the river to this part of the country. His people after that had plenty to eat. When he dug that hole through the mountains, Coyote made a kind of bridge. You've heard about it, a broad rock bridge that went across the river. People would walk from one side of the Columbia to the other. A long time afterwards, an earthquake broke the bridge down. The rocks that fell into the water formed the Cascades of the Columbia. They made it hard for boats to go up and down the river there. As with all peoples, the Indians had lots of different stories about the same things. And this is another little bit longer story about the coming of the salmon. Coyote frees the fish. Cowardy heard about two women who had fish preserved in a pond. Then he went to them as they were collecting driftwood from the river. He turned himself into a piece of wood, trying to get them to pick him up. He drifted along, but they did not get hold of him. He went ashore, ran off a bit up the river, and transformed himself into a boy. Put himself into a cradle, threw himself into the river, and again drifted along. The two women caught sight of him wailing. They thought, "Some people have capsized, and this child is drifting towards us." The younger one thought, "Let's get hold of it." But the older woman did not want to have the child. Now it was drifting along. The older one thought, "That's Coyote." Nevertheless, the younger woman took the child and put it in the canoe. The two women started towards their house. The child was wailing, and they arrived home with it, and they took it off the cradle and looked closely at it. As it turned out, the child was a boy. The younger one said, "A boy is better than driftwood." And then she went out and cut an eel and put its tail in his mouth. He right away sucked it and ate it all up. She gave him another eel, and again he sucked it, eating it up, but only half of it. Then he fell asleep, and half the eel was lying in his mouth. The two women said, "He's asleep. Let's go get some wood." And they went far away, and after they'd gone far away, Coyote arose and saw them going off. Then he made himself loose and seized their food. He roasted the fish on a spit. When the fish were done, he ate them. He caught sight of the fish, which were the women's food, in a lake. Then he examined the lake very carefully and discovered a spot where it'd be easy to make an outlet to the river. "Here I shall make the fish break out of the lake, and they shall go to the great river, the Columbia." Coyote made 5 digging sticks, made them out of young oak, and he put them down in that place. He started back home toward their house. Again, just as before, he put himself into the cradle, and again, there in his mouth lay the eel's tail. And once again, he fell asleep. Now the two women arrived. "The boy is sleeping," they said. "That's a very good boy. He's a great sleeper." And then they retired for the night. Daylight came. The boy was still sleeping. Again, the women went off for wood. And he watched them going far away. And then he got up and he took their food. He roasted it on a spit and he ate it all up. Then straight away he went out to where his digging sticks were. He took hold of one of the digging sticks. Then he struck it into the ground. He pulled it out and the earth was all loosened up. But his digging stick broke. Took another one and again struck it into the ground. He loosened up the earth and his digger was broken to pieces. He took hold of another one of his digging sticks, and again he stuck it into the ground, loosened the earth all up, and the third digger was broken to pieces. He took hold of the fourth one, and again the digger broke. Now at last he took the fifth and stuck it into the ground. He loosened the earth all up, and then the fish slid over the earth into the great river. Now the older woman thought to herself and said to her companion, "You said that child was good, but I myself thought, this is Coyote. Now, this day, Coyote Wolf treated us badly. I told you, let's not take that child as Coyote. Now we're going to become poor. Coyote's made us so. They rushed back to the house, and Coyote met them there. He said to them, "Now by what right would you keep the fish to yourselves? You two are birds, and I shall tell you something. Soon people will come into this land. Listen." And the people could be heard, a thumping noise off in the distance like thunder rumbling afar. "Now they're coming into this land, and these fish will be the people's food. Whenever a fish will be caught, you two will come, and your name will be Swallows. Now this day I've done with you, and I'm going to call you Swallows. And the people will come, they will catch fish, and you two will come, and it will be said of you, 'The Swallows have come. Coyote called them to do so.' And this is what my people will say: 'From these two swallows did Coyote take away their fish that they'd saved in a pond, and now they have come.' Thus did Coyote call these two." The conventional view we have of the settlement of North America and the American West is that the European immigrants moved westward into empty spaces, into virgin land, unoccupied territory. And they occupied it, settled it, and made it prosper. That's the way we traditionally have looked at our history: virgin land. The reality is that the land was occupied and was being used, and it was being used extensively. That actually very little of it for the culture that was here was going to waste. People had occupied the land for at least 9,000 years before the Europeans showed up. Not all the same peoples, they changed from time to time, shifted about, but people had lived here 9,000 years. When the Europeans first arrived, the native population was, it's very hard to estimate, the low estimate would be about 45,000 people living along the Columbia River. A high estimate would be about 80,000. We can say several things about those people, several very general things. One is that they were quite diverse. They were not all the same. That is one of the major errors that we non-Indians have made in the past and continue to make about, quote, the Indian. We tend to think they're all the same, or at least they're all the same in some region. That was not true. They were very different in many important ways. Secondly, besides being diverse, their lives were constantly in flux and change and in conflict. They just didn't just sit here and be the same all the time. They, like all peoples, were changing. And third, the people of this region had, compared to other native peoples in North America, or some other native peoples, had a relative amount of wealth. They were relatively well off for material wealth. It was seasonal. It was pretty hard for them sometimes to get from November to March. And some years, if the fish runs weren't large or things didn't go quite right, it could be a long and very hungry winter for people in this region. But compared to other peoples, especially in the Southwest and the upper Midwest, they had it pretty easy. And they had it easy because largely because of the fish. The salmon provided, some people used to think it provided about 80% of their diet. It probably more likely provided 30 to 40% of their food. But more important, it was a food they could store. They also had ample supplies of wood, and they also traded extensively for goods and more wealth. The native people that lived along the Columbia River, when the white people came, formed three language groups. That's the way the anthropologists usually divide them down. The three groups according to, not their language, but what are called language families, like European languages or Asian language groups. There are three language families. I've drawn them on the board. The first one, or one is called the Chinookan. It's down by the mouth of the river. Involved bands, names like Shoalwater, Chinook, Kathlamet, Clatsop, Clackamas, Wasco, Wishraw. They're Chinook Indians. They all speak, those are all different languages too. There were 21 different languages when the white man came here, as far as we know. Three language families, 21 different languages. The second language group is called Sahaptin. Included languages of the Nez Perce, the Palouse, the Cayuse, Walla Wallas, Wanapum, Yakimas, Klickitats, Umatillas. Those are all villages and different groups of people. And the third big language group goes up the coast and across and way over into Montana and up into BC. It's the largest geographic area that's called the Salish. And the people spoke that are called Okanagan, Spokane, Kalispell, Ponderay, Flatheads, all kinds of bands in British Columbia, Colvilles. So right there is a tremendous amount of diversity of language families and language groups. These people lived, they did not live in tribes. It is very inaccurate and misleading to talk about the Indian tribes of the Northwest. They lived in villages, or they lived in small bands. Sometimes 100 people, 200 people, probably largest about 500. And they always lived on the water. They lived out on the coast, they lived at the mouths of rivers, but back up along the Columbia, they lived either on the Columbia River itself or on the tributaries of the Columbia, but always by water. Water is their main means of transportation. They moved around. They moved around especially by the seasons. They'd have winter homes and summer homes, and that was governed largely by where the food was. Their main foods were huckleberries. In the fall, they'd go into the mountains, set up homes or temporary homes to pick huckleberries. At other times of the year, the fish would come. And they would go to the river, set up their homes, their longhouses, their whatever dwellings they had, their drying houses, to catch the fish and to preserve them. I think the movie last night said, and people often say this, that the Indians, when they're moving about, had no concept of private property, or no concept of property. That's incorrect. That they consider all property communal, that everybody owned everything. That's a very simple and incorrect view of what was going on. What we've done is looked at and said they don't have our concept of private property, individual private property, therefore they had no concept of property. They had a system worked out whereby they knew who had what right to what place. It's just they moved in and out of them, and they had a system of prerogatives by which one person would have the first shot at, say, the salmon, and then the next person, his brother or relative, would be next, and the next person would be next, and it worked down the line. But it was very ordered. It wasn't just take whatever you want. It belongs to everybody. And different bands could not move in on the territories of other bands. It was just understood. So there were boundaries, lines, borders, and so on. the tribes, part of their wealth was that they traded extensively. Indians living along the Columbia traded as far west as the Pacific Ocean, over what we now call Western Washington. They traded as far north as Vancouver, up into Vancouver Island. Far east is Montana, and as far south as the Great Basin, down in Utah and Nevada. And they traveled to California also. They traded and sometimes raided in fish, shells, slaves, bison robes, different kinds of tools, tobacco, beads. We're all going back and forth over the mountains to the east, to the south, or long trade routes. The great gathering places of the Columbia River Indians, great annual gatherings, were on the river. And it's where the places where they could catch the salmon the easiest. It's a mistake to think that because the salmon were so abundant back then, they just filled the streams and the river, that they could just catch whatever they wanted very easily. It took a great deal of skill to catch the salmon where they wanted to, and as I was explaining to someone before we started, you don't want to catch salmon when they're at the end of their run, or when they've gone way up a river and about to spawn. They're not very good or edible at that point. They've stopped eating as soon as they enter the freshwater, and they're running on reserve energy and wearing themselves out and beating themselves up. So you want to catch them in a place that's easy to catch them, and they're still in pretty good shape. And that would be at the Cascades of the Columbia, at the Dalles, and at Saliva Falls, the place where the river narrows down or there's rapids, and it's fish are jumping up over them, and it's relatively easy to catch them. The Indians worked out very ingenious ways of doing that with drip nets, dip nets, and weirs, and other methods. They caught the salmon, and then they dried a great deal of them. I'd like to read this passage of how the salmon were dried, at least for the benefit of the one fisherman I know is here. It's probably more than one fisherman. This was recorded in 1911, which is quite late, but they're still doing it at that point, by Edward Curtis at the Dalles. In preparation, the salmon was beheaded and gutted, and with a sharp knife, the two halves were separated from the backbone and the skin. That's what we call filleting the salmon. The clear strips thus obtained were laid on a platform in the hot sun for a day. The next morning, the flesh was soft, and the women squeezed it through their hands into shreds. Placing the mass in large dishes or in a pit lined with grass or matting, and mixing it with large quantities of roe taken from the fish. You know what roe is?
Eggs
of the fish. So you mashed up the flesh, it just started to decay, and then you mash it up more with the salmon eggs. It was then thoroughly worked over with the hands and spread on a piece of matting. After a thorough drying for 2 days, or more if the sun was not hot. And by the way, that's why they like the Dalles so much. Down in the Cascades, or down, if you drive down the Columbia River, even in the summer, as soon as you get into the gorge, you know something's changed. The weather changes. You're just hitting that eastern humidity, the western humidity. It's often even foggy in the summer. The back of the Dalles, it's in eastern Washington, and it's much hotter and much drier, and therefore much better for this drying process. It was thoroughly worked over with the hands and spread on a piece of matting after thorough drying for 2 days or more. If the sun was hot, it was pounded fine in a maple mortar with a stone pestle, and then rammed tightly in baskets of split cattails lined with fish skins. Such a package weighed from 100 to 150 pounds and was a product of about 100 salmon. Fish prepared in this way kept for months. 150-pound basket of dried sand. Besides the river and the fish, the Indians also knew the land intimately. They know the land much, much better than we know it. We hardly know it at all in our culture because we don't need to, therefore we don't bother to learn it. Their education basically was learning the land, not learning books, but learning the land. There's one native text that an anthropologist recorded, an interview, a long interview in which the native person mentioned 275 sites or places, names for places on the land. And for each one of those, he could say what plants were there and what lived there, what animals were there, an inventory of the goods of that place, 275. Different places. The Indians had in their vocabulary about 250 names for animals. If we had time, it would be an interesting exercise to see how many names of animals that all of us together could think up. I would bet it'd probably start slowing down at about 40 or 50. And they could also name or had names in their language for about 275 or more plants. But the point is they carried those in their head. They could recognize those and know where they were, know where to find them, and know how to use them. The women in this society did most of the gathering of plants. And the women, it's calculated, were responsible for providing about half the food supply. The key time for the gathering and for all the food was the fall, this time of year. This is the crucial time. They can only dry and preserve the salmon for so long, so they got to get it late in the summer. And this is when the berries are ripe. So this is when the food is being gathered, preserved, and saved, and this is going to have to get them through November, December, January, February, and March, 5 months. Indians did not usually name land forms as such or as objects like we do. They didn't necessarily put people's names on it. They named places more for either for stories, like the story I read, something that happened in the story, or as a place where something had happened. There's a suffix in the native language, two suffixes. One is P-A-M, Pam, and the other is T-A-N-A or T-A-M-A, Tama, and it just means at the place of, or at the location of. And you say the name, at the location of, and the Indian word for, many cedars. And that's how you would name a place. Just a few examples of native names. The word Yakima means the pregnant ones, or the pregnant one, I think. It's the name of some hills above. Going up the Yakima Valley, it looked like a woman lying on her back who was pregnant. The word Natchez means the first water. Klamath, yellow lily pads. Klickitat was the name of a fishing site. The first falls are going up the Klickitat River. There are some falls there as a favorite fishing site. This was called Klickitat. There's a place near Toppenish on the Yakima Reservation where there's a grove of trees, and it sort of, or was a grove of trees probably, and it's sort of shaped like a triangle and sort of stood out. It's a darker grove of trees. And the native name for that was the same as the word for pubic hair. They did have names for some places. Mount Rainier had its name. Mount St. Helens was called the one who smokes. I said Nishiwana was the name for the Columbia, it just meant the big river. it's really impossible to overestimate the importance of language and its loss and its the problem it creates of trying to understand another culture if you don't know the language. I'll read a few passages from Hun's book that emphasize this. It's not his book. Language is not merely a means of self-expression, but also a tool of survival. A tool of survival more powerful than bow and arrow, net, or plow. Language is the key. It's the key to understanding another culture. People are known by the language they speak. The biological necessities of finding food and shelter depend on detailed cultural knowledge of the natural environment, knowledge stored and transmitted by language. Human social life in all its complexity requires language, while moral commitment and spiritual satisfaction come through the inspiration of spoken words. Without the language, we really can't access the culture. We can just do what I'm doing this morning, sort of describe some bare bones of it, of how it appears. We cannot get inside the culture. And if the language goes, the culture goes. Some remnants remain, but as soon as nobody speaks the language, or the people don't speak the language, or they speak another language, in this case English, they have basically lost their culture. And we especially cannot access or get into their religion. And it's probably futile to try, or it's probably more misleading to try to get into another people's religion when you don't know their language, and just to leave it alone. I said at the beginning that the stories that I read, those kind of stories, are not their religion. They're just stories. They're often moral stories, but they're not the religion. The religion, as far as we can tell, involved attitudes toward the earth as nurturing. We use the word mother. Indians have picked that up from us. And toward the sun. The sun is sort of the counterpart to the earth or the father. The religion appears to have been animistic, which means they saw spirits in natural things, animals, rocks, trees, water, river. They practiced something called the vision quest, which is where a young person would go off and by themselves and follow a certain kind of rigid discipline and to find their spirit. The spirits inhabit everything, including people, and you have to find your spirit to find out who you are. A rough analogy would be to say it's the same as a Christian concept of vocation or a calling. Well, it's also very different from that. And finally, in their religion, according to Hun's book, at least, in interviewing people, the most sacred food of all was considered to be water. Water was a ceremonial sacred drink, just plain water. All this had gone on for centuries and centuries and probably millennia, and then three things happened which changed it perhaps forever. The first thing that happened is, well, all three things involve the coming of the Europeans. The first thing that happened as a result of the Europeans coming to the Western Hemisphere was in about 1730, 1740, in this part of the country, the horse arrived. That was a huge event. The horse, and then shortly after, then comes the gun. And those two things, the horse, but especially the horse, in a very short time, drastically changes the native culture. The second thing that happens, the second huge thing, is in 1775, disease arrives, European diseases, the first epidemic. And then I'll like to quote Hun's book. I don't consider this an exaggeration at all. He says, the history of Indian-white relations on the Columbia Plateau has been first and foremost a history of the ravages of disease, for the most part inadvertently transmitted by Old World immigrants to defenseless New World populations. The history of Indian-white relations on the Columbia Plateau has been first and foremost a history of the ravages of disease. First epidemic came 1775, another one showed up about 1783, a big one came in 1801, and after those three epidemics, the native population had been cut roughly in half. The epidemics keep coming, and eventually the native population is reduced to about 10% of what it originally was. As he says, it's just impossible for us to comprehend what that means, to put ourselves in that kind of a position and see our population wiped out to that extent by something we completely could not understand. The third big event happens with the beginning of the European exploration of the Northwest. Coming of Cook, Vancouver, Gray discovers the Columbia River, and then the Europeans start coming up the river, the fur trade begins, and then the interaction is going on. Shortly after that come the first overland explorers. David Thompson finds a route down all the way down the Columbia River. Lewis and Clark show up. The Astorians come and start a settlement at the mouth of the river, and that's the beginning of the European foothold in the Northwest. Fur trade goes on for about 30 years. Then come the missionaries. I don't have time to go into that story. We'll talk about that next week. We'll teach a course on the history of Christian missions to Indians. The missionaries come, and basically the missionaries are the vanguard, are the first opening prong of the white settlement. And they're followed by what's called, the Great Migration. For an Indian, you'd call it the Great Invasion. Thousands and thousands of white people, not quite as ridiculous looking as we saw in the film last night, but white people pouring across the land and settling in the Willamette Valley, along the Columbia and Puget Sound. Next are the treaties, which take away the land, and are followed by war. There's an Indian war along the Columbia in 1855 and 56. The tribes are initially victorious and then are defeated. And the final Indian war takes place in 1877 with the routing and then defeat of the Nez Perce Indians. After that, it's life on reservations and life governed and controlled by a federal agency called the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Indian culture, Indian life, Indian populations keep going down. The population goes down until about 1900, when it reaches its low point of about 250,000 Indians in all of North America, or all of the United States. The culture keeps going down, the poverty of the people keeps going down, and it's a question of whether they're going to survive. the common phrase at that time, is the way to refer to them, Asian Americans. And many people believed that they would be gone within a generation. For a variety of reasons, that did not happen. Population starts growing, and they survive, and they come back. And by our time, they're not only back, they're back in greater numbers, and they are asserting themselves politically. And part of what we saw in the film last night is that assertion of people who've been passive and sort of taking it for a century are now starting to say they want something, they expect something, they have some rights. Today along in the Columbia River country, there are some major reservations, the Yakima Reservation, the Colville Reservation, which is northeast of here, Spokane Reservation. Those are the three big ones in Washington State. There's the Warm Springs Reservation in Oregon. It's not on the river, but it's the Indians there are related to the river. And then there are a number of little bands scattered around who are off the reservations who obtain their own land, it's tribal land. There are a large number of bands in British Columbia. Canadians have a very different system than we do. Instead of large reservations, they have little reserves. 5 to 10 acres are scattered up along the river, the course of it, all the way to its headwaters. I've had students who've come from those reserves in my classes. Then, finally, need to realize that when we talk about the reservations, the Indians living out in the rural areas, we're talking about one half of the native population. The other half of the Indians today live in cities. They're called urban Indians. About half of the Yakimas, half of the Colvilles live in some place like Portland, Seattle, so on. The reservations today are places of severe social problems. If you look at social statistics, in almost any category, Native people will be at the bottom, or the top, however you're measuring it. Life expectancy, shortest of any people in the United States. Suicide rates, highest. Youth suicide rates, people 9, 10, 11 years old killing themselves, highest. Drug use, highest. Alcoholism, typical reservation has about 40-50% of the people are alcoholic. Alcohol fetal syndrome, off the scale. Diabetes, off the scale compared to the rest of the population. Whatever category, crime, homicide, family violence, child abuse, the reservations are the worst places for those things. All of those things are symptoms of poverty. Reservations have been very poor places for a long time. There are also other factors that contribute. It's hard to sort out why is it that way, when it appears the government's been pouring millions of dollars in trying to solve it. But that's it, and why that is, as I said, difficult to sort out. Finally, or next to finally, what are the issues between Indians and white people today? What are the issues of conflict? There are a number of them. The big ones are fish. Film we saw last night, that's probably still the number one point of contention. Who gets the fish? And will there be enough? Will there be any fish? But right up there with the fish is water rights. Who has the rights to the rivers, to the groundwater, to the streams? White people pretty much in the last century have just taken the water as they wished. But Indians have legal water rights, which they're beginning to reclaim. So we want our water, which has been taken from us. That is probably going to be more contentious and difficult than the fishing issue in the next century. Another issue is land. Tribes want some land back. They want to control their lands. I mentioned the other day about the Hanford lands. The Yakimas want the Hanford Reservation. Gambling. The tribes see gambling casinos as a way out. For some it may be, for others it's not working. But it also is setting up tensions and difficulties with the white society, having Indians have a monopoly on casino gambling. Their treaty status is always a difficult issue. What does it mean to have a very small group of people? Indians, by the way, are only 0.5% of the total population. Why do they have special privileges? Why do they have special status that nobody else has? Why do they have special rights that blacks don't have, or Hispanics? You can make a case that the blacks have had just as difficult a history in this country as the Indians have had, but they don't have treaties, they don't have special rights, privileges, preferences of the same kind. What is the future of the treaty rights? Some people say the time of the treaties is over, we should abrogate or cancel all the treaties and make the Indians equal with everybody else. That will continue to be an issue. Another issue is what is called sovereignty, or the claim of sovereignty. Indians today claim that they are sovereign nations. They no longer refer themselves as the Yakima tribe or the Yakima people. They refer themselves as the Yakima Nation, the Quinault Nation, the Colville Nation, and they claim to be sovereign. Which leads you to say, how do you define sovereignty? And what does it mean? And however you define it, it sets up problems between people. And you got one people saying, we're a separate political body here that governs ourselves and governs you if you come onto it. That causes problems. And a final area of conflict and difficulty, one that I'll talk about next week, is something called the Native American Religious Freedom Act, a special piece of legislation which says Native Americans, American Indians, have a special kind of religious freedom that the rest of the population does not have. That act was passed in 1978. And already there have been about 10 or 12 Supreme Court decisions about what it means. One more. Studying it?
Yeah, how long, when did you start interest in the subject?
Oh, when I was in graduate school, which would be about 1960, so 35 years. I want to finish by reading another story. Columbia River Tribe, although this isn't about the river. It's called Little Raccoon and His Grandmother. Little Raccoon lived with his grandmother. And by the way, that's a very common child-rearing practice and still true today. Children are often in these native cultures, reared by the grandparents and not their immediate parents. Something we might give some thought to. Little Raccoon lived with his grandmother. He was her paternal grandson, and she spoiled him. They were gathering acorns over the mountains. Acorns, by the way, were another very important food source, probably next to huckleberries. They were gathering acorns over the mountains, and one day she asked Raccoon what he wanted to eat for dinner. "Would you like some wapato?" she asked. The raccoon answered, "No, I'm tired of wapato." "Some jerky then?" "No, I'm tired of jerky." "How about some dried fish eyes?" "I don't like dried fish eyes." So Raccoon's grandmother grew angry and told him just to go out and find his own dinner. "Stay out of the acorns," she told him. Well, after a while, Raccoon came to the five pits where his grandmother was storing her winter's acorns, winter food supply. "I'm so hungry," he said to himself. And after a while, he said, "Grandmother surely won't miss one acorn." So he reached into the pit, under the dirt covering it, and took out one acorn to eat. And then another. And then another. And pretty soon the pit was empty. "Now what do I do?" he said. "Grandmother will be very angry." So he crapped once for every acorn in the pit. And then he covered it all up. But he was still very hungry. And he went out on the second pit. "Well, maybe I'll just take one more acorn," he said. But after a while, that pit was empty too. And so he filled it up, just like before, with his dung. Well, Acorn just seemed to get hungrier and hungrier. And before long, he'd eaten every acorn in each of the five pits and replaced every one with his dung. After a while, his grandmother went out to get some acorns for their supper. But when she reached into the first pit, all she felt was little pieces of dung. "Somebody's been messing around here," she said. So she went on to the second pit and reached in, felt the same thing, and went on through all five pits. She was getting angrier and angrier. "I'll bet it was that little raccoon," she said. And when she found him by the fire, she grabbed a fire stick. It's a willow wand thing that they use to carry coals around him. She grabbed the fire stick and whipped him from the nose to his tail. This is why raccoons have those stripes across their back. Little Raccoon ran away then. He thought he'd go live with some friends in a nearby village. When he arrived there, everyone came out and jeered at him. "Ha ha! Here comes that little raccoon. He stole all his grandmother's acorns and replaced them with his dung." So Little Raccoon felt silly and went on to another village. But there again, all the people ran out and ridiculed him. "Ha ha ha, there's that little raccoon. We've heard how you pilfered your grandmother's acorns and left her only dung." He was ashamed, and he went on to three more villages. But every time he arrived, the people would come out and make fun of him. So Raccoon learned how stories about the mean things you do travel way ahead of you. And he went off by himself into the woods. The story goes on. He went off by himself into the woods, About this time, his old grandmother began to feel badly about whipping her little raccoon. She felt sorry for him. So she set out to find him. But when she came to that first village, they told her that raccoon had gone on to the next village. And so on, until she had visited all five villages without finding him. She's now feeling pretty bad. Right now, Raccoon was up in a serviceberry bush eating berries when he heard his grandmother coming up the hill crying. And she was crying, "Oh, my little raccoon, where are you? Where are you?" Raccoon yelled, "Here I am, grandmother, just eating serviceberries." Pretty soon she came up, nearly blind from crying so much, and she said, "Oh, my little raccoon, I'm so hungry. Throw me some berries." Now that his grandmother had found him, that raccoon was feeling mischievous again. So he threw a whole handful of berries, leaves, and twigs right down her throat. And she began to choke. "Ka, ka," she cried. "My raccoon, I'm choking. Here, take my basket and get me some water." So that raccoon climbed down, took the hat, and ran to a creek and filled it up. But he was feeling mean again. So he poked a hole in the hat, and by the time he got back, he only had a little water. "Ka, ka," cried the grandmother. "Get me some more water." So Raccoon went to fetch her water again, but he poked another hole and brought her even less water this time. He was obeying her, but not really. Each time he went, he poked another hole in the hat and brought back a little less and a little less, until the fifth time, when the grandmother could hardly talk, he brought her only one drop of water. And just as he handed her the basket this time, she cried, "Ha, ha, ha," once more, and turned into a blue jay and flew off, scolding the way blue jays do. Little Raccoon just sat down and cried. It was all his fault. Okay, that's over time. Sorry it takes so long. Did you notice something about those stories? There's a number of things about the culture. There's one thing about the culture in them that stands right out when you read them. It's different from our culture.
Oh, there's a lot of animals.
Yeah, there's animals and people all mixing together. What would you say is the most important number in our culture?
Seven?
Oh, five.
Three.
Five,
maybe. In our culture?
Seven.
Seven, or maybe three? Three or seven,
well, I'd say. One, if you're in that type of brain.
Yeah. I'm a Unitarian, so one. In the Northwest Indian culture, the plateau culture, we've been talking about the sacred number, or the significant number, there's a term for it, I can't remember. The significant number is five. It comes up again and again and again. Five of this, five of that. Remember the first story about opening the lake, the coyote went over and he had made five things, and he dug five times, and on the fifth time it worked. And then in this story, it's the five pits,
That's interesting, because I've been taught my whole life that that's the Japanese number, it's five.
Yeah. Well, the cultures vary. It's not universal that everybody thinks certain numbers are special. But five was the number, the most frequently used number.